Blog Talk Radio.
No. Wait. Turn it up. Wrong music. It's Christmas time. We have to have something a little bit different.
Great music, Tracy.
Welcome to American Conservative Radio. It's Christmas time. I'm Tracy Coyle.
And I'm Bill Hinman.
Good evening, Bill.
Good evening, Tracy. That was great music. I love this time of year.
On September 25th, my mother turns down the Christmas music.
Very good.
After October 31st, Victoria turns down the Christmas music.
Yeah, and who waits for after Thanksgiving anymore?
At Thanksgiving time, I turn on the radio station that plays Christmas music for the next month. And
there you go.
I was listening to Christmas music today, and I decided, you know, we need, the bumper music just needs to be a little bit different for this season. You know, Cruisin' for Bruisin' out of Enya is a really good way to start things off, but, you know, we're just going to be a little bit more within the season.
There you go.
In the season. So I thought that would be a nice way to open us up for the next couple weeks, and we'll actually use it at the end also. So
excellent.
We get a nice little piece that's from the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. It is Christmas Eve and Other Stories. It's very good CD if you guys have an opportunity to listen to it. It's one of my favorites. So we'll play that on a fairly opening basis. Let's get the news of the evening out of the way.
Yes.
I'm disappointed.
Oh, no. Really?
Well, you know, you asked me about this when we talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
About how I could have that particular point of view, and the
yep.
reality is that is my point of view. I'm kind of stuck in that position where just because he's a Republican doesn't mean that we should be voting for him.
Yeah, I know.
Although, I understand that he is a little bit more conservative than some,
mm-hmm.
but the reality is, as I suggested to somebody this evening, whose name will remain, well, actually, he's online. Good evening, Rick.
Hi.
Hi, Rick.
How are you, Bill?
I'm doing well tonight, sir, and how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Well, as I was saying to Rick earlier on, you know, my mind is that, frankly, Obama should be given all the rope he needs.
And a filibuster-proof majority would give that to him, right?
It would give him the rope factory, and the land to grow the hemp.
Oh, man. Boy, that just sends shivers right up my spine.
The other part about that is, really, is it going to make much of a difference between having 58 or 60 with the rhinos that we have in place?
You know, probably not. But basically there's about three really reliable Republican votes for Democrats. You have Olympia Snow, you've got Arlen Specter, and the other name escapes me. Wicker. That's the other guy.
Lowell. Yeah, I don't know that it's going to make that much difference. I'm pretty certain Franken is not going to be in the Senate. But let me tell you, if he was, then I don't know that I could do anything but other than to replace the seal of the Senate with a Bozo the Clown.
Yeah, that would be a really great logo, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I just can't imagine. You know, Victoria has said, you know, we have had, you know, TV characters in elected offices before, but, you know, the character of Franken suggests that I don't think there was a whole lot of Democrats that were hoping that he was going to win. So,
well, that whole DFL labor folks have got to be pretty pretty thankful, I think, at this point.
Well, so Chambliss has won. Rick, you were informing me. I have not paid attention. I've been out of the loop for the last couple of hours.
Right.
Was it a convincing win?
Well, I don't know how convincing it was. They're still counting, really. But you know, the Martin's already conceded. So.
Oh well, there's a good sign.
Okay, I would suggest that 3 hours is probably, you know, a pretty good indicator that he's going to get swamped. Okay, that's fine. We'll see what happens as we move forward. Speaking of moving forward, Barack Obama announced yesterday a bunch more of his future cabinet choices, among them being the Honorable Senator from New York, Hillary Rodham Clinton, as Secretary of State.
Yep.
Your opinion, good idea, bad idea, who's bad idea, who's good idea?
Rick, you going to field that one for a while?
I don't know. I'm really at a loss to say what I think about that. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, she doesn't have any foreign policy experience. You know, I kind of almost think it was like he's appeasing her by giving her that position.
But I don't think he had to do that.
Well, he didn't, but that's, you know, he's said a lot of trying to unify the Democrats behind him. And maybe
he's appeasing the party?
That's my opinion.
It strikes me that there's a whole lot of Clinton retreads in his cabinet. I'm not real sure that we have an Obama administration as we have a Clinton III administration.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm, you know, somebody suggested, and I agree with them pretty much, that, you know, if you're going to be a Democrat coming into, you know, an administration, you're going to pull from the people that have had the most experience most recently, and that's going to end up being a lot of Clinton people anyways. I did have a question. I only caught it in the news today. Ambassador to the UN, is that the same Rice that was booted off of his foreign policy team during the primaries, or right after the primaries, for being
bad things? Yep, it sure was.
I kind of thought that, and I'm kind of thinking, like, there's got to be a few heads scratching in Israel at this point. Their time is getting rather short. What have they got, about 50 days? 50 days to act. Will they act? Do you think Israel will act, given that particular indication from Obama of what his administration is going to be aimed towards as far as the UN is concerned? No one wants to jump in on that one, huh?
Well, as far as the UN is concerned, no. The UN has consistently been anti-Israel. I mean,
well, and now Obama is giving them an anti-Israel UN ambassador.
Yes, he is. Absolutely.
Does that suggest to Israel that their status, as far as this administration is concerned, is going to be less cordial than under previous administrations?
It's the way I'd play it if I were Israel. Absolutely. I think I would have to start looking at what my whole cards were and what I would have to do to make sure that my nation didn't cease to exist.
Well, I'm a little bit... I saw that and I thought it was kind of interesting that he put her out there after getting rid of her.
Yep.
During the
primaries, and the general election.
Yeah, it just didn't make any sense. But, you know, who has said it? Was it Hugh Hewitt that said bait and switch? We've got a
yep.
whole lot of that going on. Maybe
yeah.
it's just another one. I want to bring on another caller. I believe we've got Butch out there. Is that Butch? Or we got Jason?
Well, howdy.
That is Butch. Hey, Butch, how are you?
I'm all right. I can't complain. Wouldn't help.
Oh, yeah. I like complaining. That's okay. It gets things fired up.
Yeah.
Well, it's all Obama's fault anyway.
You know, at least we have somebody to blame it on now.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that's not a Republican or whatever. Well, I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
I'm contemplating the future of the Republican Party.
Are you really?
Yes, I am.
Are you thinking about joining there?
I'm trying to decide. Trying to decide if, in fact, it is something that's going to be able to hold on by the skin of its teeth and reconstitute itself in the future, or if it's actually just going to the way of nations in the history of the world, you know, die a long, slow, painful death.
Well, the Republican Party has been in a worse position before. You know, the Republican Party was in the wilderness for 40 years.
Yep.
You know, and they, you know, the Republican Party actually operates much better when they're in the wilderness. So no, I don't think they're. I don't think it's a dying institution by any stretch. either the leadership needs to, have a huge overhaul, and a different direction needs to be taken, or we're all in trouble. But I don't think that would mean if they didn't take that direction. I don't think the party would be in trouble. I just think all of us would be.
My thought was back in the '60s and '70s. There were, I believe, and I'm having to pull, you know, snippets of history out of my brain to do this. I believe there were, you know, solid conservatives in the Republican Party while they were wandering in the wilderness. And I'm not so certain at this point in time that the Republican Party has that type of leadership.
Oh,
you know,
sure they do. Sure they do. There are plenty of true blue conservatives in the Republican Party.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that they're there, but the question is, they're not in leadership positions.
Yeah, but they're going to be. I'm not trying to float smoke out up the Republican Party's behind. Given while we're all here, but what those people are going to have prominent roles, and if they don't, there's a reason why those people are popular, the Jindals and the Sanfords and the Palins and the, those. I mean, I'm pulling out governors, but there are others as well that are.
Cantor is thought highly of.
Who's that?
Cantor.
Cantor. Well,
he's
Cantor.
Highly of.
Yeah, Cantor. Yeah, Cantor's a Virginian. So.
And Paul Ryan, who's Congress critter from just south of me here.
Right.
Seems to have a pretty solid fiscal conservative head on his shoulders.
Yeah, and I think even given while we're here, I mean, I think it's important for us to continue to support those people, because if not, you know, it's going to be, you know, terrible for everybody if the Republican Party goes down the path of, you know, pandering to the middle or whatever the logic, whatever logic led to a McCain nomination.
Yeah, right.
And that's the worst indicator of where the Republican Party is going, is a McCain nomination. I'm hoping that mistake isn't made again next time, but, you know, maybe it will be. And if so, they'll lose again, and that's okay. I mean, you know, like I said, it won't be the first time.
I agree. We need to support conservatives no matter where we find them.
Exactly, and there are Democrat conservatives.
There are a dozen or so, you know, on the legislative side that are solid conservatives, and there are some that are blue dog, meaning, hey, you know, we want to be responsible with your money, kind of conservatives as well, which, you know, I wouldn't really call that insanely conservative, but it's better than the other end of that party.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to, I mean, we do have to support conservatives wherever they are.
Yep.
So.
Well, I suggested that we started talking about Hillary for a second.
Sure.
And I'm going to go back into this thing because something has been raised. It's been raised in the past and ignored, apparently, pretty much in the past. I hadn't heard about it. It was done at a time when I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to politics in general. And this is the idea that it is not constitutional for a sitting senator or congressperson to take an executive branch cabinet position during a time when that cabinet position's salary has been increased, when that senator or congressperson has been sitting in office.
I wasn't aware there was a Secretary of State increase.
Yes, there was.
What?
I'll be damned.
Condi got a raise.
Yep. $4,000 a year or something like that.
So, you know, apparently it was just a plain cost of living raise.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some arguments as if it's just cost of living, it doesn't apply. But then what cost of living? It's going to be rather... I think it's going to get about as much play as Obama's birth certificate.
And it shouldn't get any play. I mean, I just don't think it's relevant, really.
Right.
Well, and not only that, but it is not a precedent. There have been other secretaries of state that have been in the same situation. What the president has done has been to, with the consent of Congress, to lower the pay, if you will, of the Secretary of State to that which
it was before
obtained
the...
previously, and that apparently circumvents the whole constitutional argument.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've learned having worked with Victoria for the last 10 years is that words have meaning.
Yes, they do.
And the reversing a pay raise is not the same thing as if the pay raise never existed. The question is, as far as legal is concerned, whether it's void or voidable. And I'm not going to get into a constitutional argument. I did not stay at a Holiday Inn Express over the holiday weekend.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit outside, and not above, not below, but it's a little bit outside of my particular pay grade.
And forgive me, Tracy, is Holiday Inn Express sponsoring the show? We probably shouldn't mention that.
I'm actually trying to get some
I just wanted to point that out.
I'm just trying to get some free, you know, stays come holiday period.
There you go.
That's the constitutional people are making those arguments. It's only being done on the blogs for the most part. Bill's right. This is not a precedent-setting thing. It's happened several times before. They've pretty much ignored it, gone around it. it's interesting that it's being raised again with Hillary. But then again, you know, we got a whole lot of senators involved in this election. And
this was a senator's election. I mean, let's just be honest. I mean,
boy, wasn't it?
I mean, that's what it's all about. That, you know, when's the last time that, you know, the sitting legislators have had a chance at executive power? You know, I mean, it hasn't happened in a long, long time.
We're gonna have. Let's see. We're gonna have, now that the election is over, we're going to have to replace three senators. We've got Stevens in Alaska,
right.
Hillary in New York, and Obama in Illinois. All have to be replaced.
What about Rahm Emanuel and
but he's a Congress critter.
He's a Congress critter, but still, I mean, look at Bush's administration and tell me how many congressmen are in there. And senators. I mean, I can't think of any that. I mean, there may have been a few that have had legislative experience, but very, very few. Those guys all came from Texas and various and sundry, you know, Reaganite executive posts. You know.
Well, wasn't Cheney a sitting senator?
He was at one time, but
not at the time that Bush.
Not for a long time.
See, yeah. my history ends apparently around 1793.
Yeah.
You know, I was guilty of that at one time as well.
Yeah, as was I.
Yeah.
I'm much more attuned to what the history was than what the history is.
Yep. That sounds like a very progressive view of things. That's very disappointing.
Yes, well, I'm working at it. I could name Stevens and Cantor. I'm working on it.
That's very impressive, actually. Yeah, good job.
It's not an elephant in the room, but events of the holiday weekend. I tried not to spend too much time glued to the TV. On Thursday and Friday, I really tried pretty hard to avoid all the stuff that was going on. Mumbai, is it India's 9/11?
Well, boy, if it isn't, those folks aren't paying a lot of attention.
Well, I mean, two reasons why I'm not sure that it's really their 9/11. Number one is the volume of casualties isn't exactly to the level of 9/11. Two, it's not like that country hasn't had terrorist attacks before. It wasn't completely unprecedented, but at that scale it was insanely unprecedented. Whereas there, I'm not sure whether it is or not. I'm just operating under the assumption that they've had terrorist attacks before. I could be way wrong. But it is definitely, if it's not their 9/11, it's definitely their, you know, Oklahoma City bombing or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's a serious deal.
It should be a wake-up call.
I would say it was their 93 World Trade Center bombing, and they better pay attention. But that's just, you know, that's... speculative.
I don't think this is going to escalate any particular tensions between Pakistan and India, despite everything that appears to be being said and going on.
Well, it could have been done to for the intent of doing that, and if everybody knows that, then that'll probably help.
I spent a little bit of time thinking about guns and how people can be, I don't want to say complacent in the face of, you know, horrors in front of them, but I would suggest to you that before 9/11, the hijackers could get away with hijacking a plane. After 9/11, a hijacker doesn't have a hope in hell of being able to take a plane. They may take it for a few moments, but they're not going to keep it.
But why?
Because I don't think people took it as a threat, that a plane was a threat, or a hijacker was a threat.
Right.
One person could not be a threat.
Right.
In the big scheme of things, it wasn't a threat. Now, you know, a big old, you know, 300,000-pound airliner doing 600 miles an hour, you know, that's a threat. And it's a threat that's not going to be allowed to, you know, persist.
Yeah, but what's going to prevent them from doing what they intend to do with the plane if they were to do something like 9/11? What would prevent them from doing it right now?
If I was on a plane and somebody hijacked a plane, I'd be running for the door.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, before, everybody was under the mentality, the kind of the 80s mentality, hey, they're just trying to get hostages out of Lebanon, let's just let them land, we'll be okay. It's kind of like somebody robbing a bank, just, you know, it's FDIC insured, you know, don't sweat it. But after 9/11, people were like, well, you know, just tackle the son of a bitch. Four or five of us can take him, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, and it's not worth it's worth the risk, in other words, whereas before you didn't feel like it was. But all that to say that it's not security and, you know, whatever, 1 liter plastic bags with 3 ounce containers of liquids that are preventing you know, I think it's humans realizing that, you know, that it's not, they're not going to put up with it. You know, I don't see that type of attack happening again, for the reason that the passengers know that, you know, a couple of schmucks take over the plane, that we're not going to let them take over the plane.
And the question is, you know, I don't think that, you know, five two-man teams wandering around the New York subways with guns is going to get quite as far as those in Mumbai did.
Right.
I think they're likely to receive a much different thing. I think that's all a good thing for us. I don't think we're likely to be as complacent as we were. I think, and I've read it, and a lot of places have commented upon it, about this idea, and Bill and I joked about it a couple, you know, at the night of the election. You know, can you feel the love, people? You know, the world loves us now. The world is going to be terror-free.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and, you know, people are surprised that terrorism is still happening. Well, how could that possibly be true?
Well, because Obama's going to set us free. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm afraid for the mentality of the people, because it apparently is a large number of people that have that mentality. And it gets kind of, you know, odd, because I'm going to read a little something for you. It was a report from Friday. The Iraq Veterans Against the War,
mm-hmm,
staged an anti-war protest in San Francisco in one of the malls. And this was what their... Now, Mumbai was in the middle... Mumbai was still going on at this point in time. So we had... That was still going on in the news. These morons, in uniform, went running through the malls, pointing at people, going rat-a-tat-tat, shooting at them. Now, they didn't have guns in their hands, but they were running through the mall, shooting at people. Frankly, I'm surprised nobody shot. Well, it was San Francisco. They were probably safe.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's places where that likely to get them shot, you know, or at least tackled pretty badly. But that mentality seems to be too prevalent, even in this non-complacent society. And I'm concerned that we are going to swing in certain ways the other way. I suggested it a long time ago that, in my predictions back in February, that Obama might be faced with imagine a Mumbai-type attack here in the United States, not spread out over a city, but spread out over a month. You know, five or seven small two-person, one or two-person attacks that actually does some pretty serious carnage over a number of places.
Or
you know,
like
hitting a sports theater or a church, a mall, things
high
like
school.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know if you guys watched 24, but I mean, those kind of incidents or coordinated attacks. Again, 24 is not sponsoring the show either, so.
Right.
But there were several. I mean, out of the six or seven seasons, you know, three of them have been, you know, one day of trying to put out numerous terrorist type. Incidents all kind of happening at once, or one after the other, or contingency
mm-hmm.
plans, or
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the kind of attack that, and that's what 9/11 was.
I'm concerned that you know the response to that. You know, I want an aggressive response to that, but I'm concerned about a certain kind of response that Rick, you. Kind of informed me of this evening, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about how one of our states seems to think that they have the right approach for this.
Well, I don't think it's the state. I think it's coming from the government, and from what I understand, it's been in the works for several years. They're talking about putting 20,000 standing troops out there as a fast response team. To jump in wherever they're needed and help police things. And my concern with that is it turns us into a police state.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, this is and Tracy, this is Jason. Also, I read actually the same report, and I don't know if many people know about this, but there's actually a federal law restricting military's role in domestic law enforcement. It's called the Posse Comitatus Act. It's about 130 right. years old. You know, a lot of liberty-minded people and people that are mindful of that law are making their voices heard, especially on that 20,000 uniformed troop situation.
But, Rick, they've already addressed that, yes?
Well, they're talking. That I've been hearing it back and forth. Most of what I've heard was on talk radio, where it's being pretty thoroughly discussed. And they've already got a budget for it. You know, $1.8 billion allotted to it. So it seems to me they're going to go with it, whether it's legal or not.
I'm not, yeah, and Jason, I've kind of the same concerns. I'm not real, I don't like the idea of putting our military in that type of position. I can see them, I don't even see them as a fast response team to, you know, dumping them into a Mumbai-type situation.
Well, And not only that, but, I mean, you have to think of, you know, what role does our state government or our governor-controlled National Guard forces, what do they do? You know, what's their role in all this? We already have them.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Our National Guard is a National Guard. I mean, it's you know, when people bring up the National Guard having to do with the Second Amendment, I always correct them and say there's nothing really militia-like about our National Guard.
No,
it's a National Guard. And sure, the government, the governor has authority over them, but they get called to do interstate things, international things now. So I'm with you. I don't think that. I think their role needs to be refocused on, you know, what their role is, and that is to guard their state.
Right.
Just to play devil's advocate here, what would be the difference between the kind of force that we're talking about here, 20,000 troops, which, as I understand it, is a mix of regular army and National Guard troops, responding to a Katrina type of situation, and that same mix of troops responding to a weapon of mass destruction type of an attack on this country.
I don't see the value of using military units in either of those situations. Now, I understand why and how they get used is because, first of all, they often have the equipment and the ability to mobilize, and they're trained to, for a certain amount of, discipline as far as installing order into a disordered area. So I understand the value and the use of it. I just don't know that it's a brilliant idea. You know, I'm thinking on my, I was going to say thinking on my feet here, but I am sitting. You know, what happens if the FBI has a SWAT squad, that's, 500 or 600, strong that can descend on something like that, descend on a problem that's a, Katrina doesn't need a SWAT squad.
But that's a lot of what they got. They got a lot of that. Because one of the first things that the military did in helping secure the area and the aftermath of Katrina was confiscate weapons.
I thought that was mostly the police force that did that. Right.
Well, the way I understand it, it was a mixture of, and there was, a lot of weapons confiscation, and it was the, when the military comes into an area, their first inclination is to take over.
Yes.
Now, that's what they're trained to do. They're trained to secure an area,
right.
And if they have to fight to do it or they have to talk to do it, that's what they're going to do. So if you put a military squadron or whatever you want to call them into an area, they're going to secure that area by whatever means.
Well, this goes back to, in my opinion, the challenge that we have fundamentally in our Federalist mentality or lack thereof. I mean, is anybody ever watch? I keep on bringing up TV shows, but that's how I learned. Does anybody ever watch Jericho?
Yeah,
right. Well, I mean, the problem that, and the reason I find that show so enthralling is not because it's well written or well acted. I think there's flaws there, but the whole concept of a town in the middle of nowhere being left without a federal government, and for a while being fairly helpless, I think that's kind of the challenge, And Charlie brought up over the email the other day, one of the issues that he was looking into as far as his local, his state is, what kind of preparedness does the state have, and local law enforcement, as in counties and state police and, local law enforcement have in the way of managing, disasters or terrorist attacks or, whatever. And the truth is they're fairly, and I can't say this about all states, and I don't know any details, but I think that our state law enforcement has become dependent upon, federal enforcement. Now, in the case of Katrina, not that I know anything about it, but I, have spent a little time most of my life in Louisiana. Katrina was a function of a lack of executive leadership from the state level. There's only so much that a mayor can do in something that profound. So they do look up, and the first step up is the governor. And the governor dropped the ball. I mean, from everything I know about it, from everything I've read about it, and maybe I'm wrong, but, the governor dropped the ball.
Yes,
and, the governor could have nationalized it, passed the buck up another step, which is her prerogative. But she didn't. She balked. So that can't happen, right? That's not, that's not a good idea. And I think that the national government has a role, but I think the choice should be at the state level,
and the local level when, you know, when, you know, when you have to call on the next level up, a larger, you know, a larger scale, you know, assault or protection or, you know, whatever the term is to alleviate, you know, whatever the threat is. And but there needs to be coordination between those three, and the first line of defense should be the local and not the federal. And when you develop a force for the purpose of protecting a federal force for the purpose of protecting in a certain area, then what you're doing is you're making the federal the first line of defense. You know.
Right.
Sure, the natural inclination is going to be for the locals to say, oh, well, the feds have that covered. We don't have to worry about it.
And what happens when the Fed goes away because D.C. is,
yep.
you know, bombed or, you know, or Colorado or
whatever.
And or the federal has been taken over, you know, by some
mm-hmm.
evil, you know, fascist, you know, then what do we do, right? I mean, I hate to sound conspiratorial and gloom and doom because I hope nothing like that ever happens, but the point is we as communities, and I mean even at the town level, you know, I live in a town of, I don't know, what, you know, 50, 60,000 people, you know, even the town needs to know and to be trained and to understand, okay, what do we do? What do the local sheriffs and cops do? If something drastic happens, what do we have at our disposal? Because the number one role of government is to protect, you know, the citizens. And if the local cops aren't going to do it and they're going to defer to the state cops and the state cops are going to defer to the federal, then why don't we just nationalize the whole damn thing and be done with it?
Well,
yeah.
first of all...
Not a good idea.
They're
not a good
supposed
idea.
To be protection. They're supposed... You know, we are supposed to protect... The first line of defense is us.
Well, sure.
You know,
me and my wife and a gun.
Well, I'm sorry?
Me and my wife and a gun. You know, I mean, that's...
Right.
Yeah.
And let me interject into that. If you think about Mumbai and you think about that reporter-photographer that witnessed the assault on, I believe it was the airport, and saw armed policemen not offering any resistance whatsoever to those terrorists. And then you think, if that government can't protect me, how in the world do I protect myself? And the answer is, if you have an armed citizenry, then you have at least that first line of defense.
Yeah, I mean, that's case in point for the Second
mm-hmm.
Amendment. You know, I mean, yeah.
Rick?
Yes.
Yeah.
We started taking off on your comments, but I wanted to give you a chance to jump back in if you wanted to raise another point about that.
Well, I mean, just tag along to something Bill just said. India is one of the most anti-gun countries in the world. They have some of the strictest anti-gun laws in the entire world.
Yeah.
But from what I had heard about that situation in the airport, those police were under strict orders not to fire their weapons without authority from upstairs.
Yeah, rules of engagement will kill you.
ROE, yeah.
So they were thinking they were doing their job. Well, it happened in our country.
It happens in our country. It happens too much in our country.
Right.
You know, people are, you know what? It happens in reverse in this country. People that should engage people like that do engage people like that, and then they get in trouble for having done so.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's
true. And that may, fortunately, I don't think it happens. It probably happens too much, but probably not as much as I'm concerned by it. That prevents somebody else from possibly engaging at a future point because they're afraid of what might happen afterwards.
Absolutely.
But I think most of our first line people, you know, our first responders, are Americans first, which means, you know, shoot first, you know, answer the review board later. I'm frankly of that particular mindset in most regards myself. You know, I'm going to do what's right, even if it's wrong, and I'll deal with the consequences later. And I'm convinced that there's enough of us still walking around in this country that I don't think Mumbai would have lasted 50 hours in New York or Miami.
No.
Well, I don't know about New York, but I can tell you that
it could have lasted a lot longer in San Francisco. That, you know,
it would still be going on in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned because we had something happen that didn't. It would have made the news, but it didn't because of Mumbai. And apparently, Juarez, Mexico, is getting to be a real little nice town to go visit. Especially if you're interested in getting dead.
20 people in less than 24 hours.
Right. Actually, that did make the front page of the Fox News website.
Okay.
It's interesting that this is that we're having this conversation right now because about a year ago I was concerned about this one thing that we're talking about right now is basically citizen preparedness. And I did some research, and there is a website that the government put out, and it's called citizencorps.gov. And basically, you can go in and actually look for city councils near you, and basically most of them are in the major municipalities that are close to you. And the only thing it deals with really is food storage, what to do in this case in a national disaster or a terrorist attack. Or to get your CERT first responder training and such things like that. But it really doesn't go into, basically the need for a true first line of defense. And typically in the past, 200 years ago, we were the first line of defense.
Yeah.
What do we got, 39 states with concealed carry at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's going up. I mean, that's one area of our laws that has been moving further and further to the right, for the last 15, 20 years. Every
mm-hmm.
state has gone from, many, many states have gone from very, very strict laws to, what's the term? Bill, you probably know this term. For concealed carry permit, it's...
shall issue as a
shall
to,
issue.
Yeah,
yeah, almost
right.
All like 39 states are shall issue, and they're all moving towards that.
Yep.
Which given the other trends, I think is one bright spot we should thank God for every day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, because in every single state where it gets in there, the result is exactly the same.
Yeah, and
less crime.
The joy of federalism and having 50 different labs to figure out, what works best.
It was really interesting to me. Florida was kind of the first. They were the bellwether state on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And the lib argument was, oh God, we'll have blood in the streets and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But when you take a look at Florida, and you look at their crime statistics from the time that was the inception of that, their crime statistics have gone down. Forcible rape has gone down. Murders have gone down. All of the armed confrontational things have gone down, and people are safer.
Yeah,
John Lott,
another direction as well.
Absolutely. John Lott has done some really great statistical research on the effects of must issue, shall issue concealed weapon permits and the rate of crime. And it's absolutely astounding when you look at those statistics and you say, any politician that opposes that basically wants to say, I don't care if you get raped and robbed and that kind of stuff. I just have this real gut reaction to guns, and I don't like them, and I don't want you to have them. And,
it's
absolutely astounding
person,
to me.
If I were a single person, I would get a permit.
Yep.
And it's not because of CJ. CJ is a black belt in karate. She has been trained on 3 weapons. And she's not allowed to fight people because she could be arrested.
Sure.
For that. In this household, Victoria has a say. This is not a democracy. It's a dictatorship. And
the individual sovereignty doesn't work in the household, does it?
Oh,
there?
Dang. Yeah.
Tragic, isn't it?
It is tragic. I am sovereign in my skin, and that's
there
about as far as it can get.
About as
there you
it goes with that house. I know. I'm married to you.
Yes, we have, you know, such is life.
Yeah.
But that is, you know, she's very, very opposed to it, and I understand her particular aversions to it. But, you know, except for that, there would be a weapon in this house.
You know, that is one segment of the economy that
right.
has done pretty well the last few weeks.
Yes, it has.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, because, you know, and I can understand that. I understand it from a slightly different perspective. I'm a pretty firm believer that when government goes to hell in a handbasket, society's not far behind.
Probably true.
I'm not so much worried about government knocking down the door coming to take my weapon as I am somebody knocking down my door trying to take my food.
Yep.
A lot of that was actually seen in Katrina as well.
Yes, it was.
And that's why the people were taking away weapons.
Yep. And that's, I believe there was a firearms law or a law brought down from the government that actually restricted the removal or the taking away of guns or firearms as a result of that, because they actually realized that they were actually hurting the situation.
Right. You know,
there have been a number of states that have prohibited police departments in a time of crisis of picking up firearms.
Right, right.
Yeah, a number of states that have done that.
Yeah.
Well, I was fine here. We had a tax-free gun purchase weekend over Thanksgiving holiday.
Boy, I tell you what, I wish I sure could have taken advantage of that.
I wish I had the money. I would have gone and bought something. But that was a response to a bill that got put out into our state senate by a Democrat who wanted to impose stricter gun control. So Mark Sanford, who's my personal hero, as you guys all know, declared it a tax-free weekend for firearms.
Way to go,
I'm
Mark.
Yeah. Good job.
When you want more of something, remove the tax. When you want less of something, put more taxes on it.
That's right.
There you go. Well, he had a, if you get a chance to look it up, he did an interview with Sean Hannity the other day. And he basically blasted the Republican leadership. So it's just an interesting read.
Republican leadership in South Carolina?
No, in the nation.
Oh, okay.
He is a Republican leadership in South Carolina.
Well, he's the governor, but I thought maybe he was lambasting the state legislature or something.
Well, from what I've gathered in the last couple of weeks, listening to a lot of conservative talk radio, because that's what I do all day, a lot of people here agree with us. The problem is they decided they want to fix the Republican Party rather than go another way.
Right, and that's kind of where I was suggesting very, very, very early in this conversation. You know, contemplating the future of the Republican Party, you know, there is a large segment that wants to fix the Republican Party, and I don't necessarily have a big problem with that because it certainly needs it. But there is a certain number of people that have also just said, you know, I'm tired of trying to fix what is, you know, not habitually broken, but is in fact designed to be broken like that. And I'm tired of fighting it. And it kind of came home to me this weekend, over the last 6 or 7 days, we've had a person new to the website that has been talking about, you know, where have we been? Why didn't he know about us in the past? And he was equally concerned by the fact that we had already done a lot of work here on American Conservative Party, and nobody talked to him about it. It is the idea that part of the reason the Republican Party is broken is because too many of us, I am a one of the people that can be blamed for this, too many of us have abdicated our responsibilities towards the political parties, towards the governments, to take over, to do those things that are supposed to be our responsibility. And I listened, I read what he was saying, and I just said, here is another person who has said, things are broken, and you tried to fix it, but why didn't you let me know? And I'm sitting there like going, because, you know, you weren't interested 8 months ago. Or a year ago. Not enough to go looking for us. Not enough to go looking for something other than what was out there. And I think that's what, you know, first of all, I wasn't real polite to him. If you want to read some of my responses to his postings, go to the website, www.AmericanConservativeParty.org.
Good job, Tracy.
Read some of those comments. I wasn't polite because he started from the premise that now that he sees things are broken, he wants to know why somebody hasn't told him that somebody's trying to fix it. And that's an abdication of his responsibility. It's not my responsibility. It's not our responsibility to fix it for him, to make him aware that things are broken and he needs to be an adult, he needs to be an American, he needs to take back those responsibilities and act upon them. And others have done so already and are continuing to do so. I want people like that that have said things are broken and we need to do things about it. But I don't want them coming in here, coming in to anywhere, whether it be the Republican Party, the Conservative Party, anywhere, and thinking that, well, you know, why weren't you telling me? You know, it's not our responsibility. It is our personal responsibility to take that first motion. It's not the party's responsibility, not Republican parties, not the American Conservative Party's responsibility to go and shake you up and make you pay attention to the problems that are existing. We're just about out of time. Rick, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Jason, I want to thank you. We didn't get a chance to say hello to Jason from New Hampshire, but glad you could join us this evening.
Thank you, Tracy.
And Butch, glad to have you on again, as always.
I enjoyed
and
it. Always a pleasure.
I'm going to let Bill give us our, you know, final out.
Okay. I can do that. It is apparent to me that people in this country are more conservative than they believe themselves to be. All of the things that we have talked about tonight, I think that if you did a poll of them, that you would find that there was a very broad agreement on the things that we have talked about. Our difficulty and our challenge is that we need to educate people that the things that they feel in their own personal lives are the things that we stand for. And we stand for a very grand and great tradition in this country, which is personal responsibility.
It's off.
We're done? I didn't hear the music.
When I gave it to you, the music was on.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I didn't hear the music.
Way to
okay.
go, Christy.
We're done. Thank you, folks.
Y'all take care.
I'm gone.
Thanks, Bill. All right, take care.
Night.
Thanks, guys.
Night.